This is a continuation of the interview with Lorenzo Rubio on March 7th.
Okay, so so prior to this particular job, I was working with community corrections in the minimum security detention, which is right across the street from here.
Okay.
So, and that was very enjoyable. I got to meet a few people, and they actually, the sheriff actually hired me away from them. So, and at that point, when they hired me for this position, my wife actually went to work for community corrections as a parole and probation officer. Okay. So we kind of switched agencies. Switched,
You must know Jose Jaime over there.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, I knew Jaime when he was working as a priest.
Years ago then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in fact, we get together once in a while. He walks right across the street. And I also belong to the advisory board for community corrections. So we have a monthly meeting, in fact, tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. What would you say? Well, can you maybe tell me about some of your more interesting experiences here working in this position of? It sounds like one of your official titles is liaison with between the sheriff's office and the Hispanic community.
But yeah.
It sounds like you get involved quite frequently whenever there's interaction between the sheriff's office and the Hispanic community.
One that really stands out in my mind and was a very volatile issue in the Hispanic community was the fact that a few years ago, and this must have been maybe 4 years ago or so, close to between 4 and 5, the sheriff's office had an INS agent working, not really working with us, but he was deputized. And when the Hispanic community found out about it, they were up in arms. Mostly because of the fact that, you know, the INS was so intrusive anyway. And having police powers, it just, you know, somewhere we knew that it was against the law for police agencies to be doing INS work. And so because of the close relationship that this INS officer had with the sheriff's office, we just felt there was a conflict. And so we had, I mean, it caused a big uproar in the community. And to the point where, you know, ultimately the sheriff, you know, disassociated himself with the INS.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably a big controversy that really motivated a lot of Latinos here in Washington County.
Uh-huh.
So every once in a while, out of that we formed a group called Police Hispanic Community Relations Committee, PHCRC. And so we met on a monthly basis, and it involved agencies from the sheriff, Beaverton Police, Forest Grove, Cornelius, Hillsborough, and then other agencies that work specifically with Hispanics. So we had a continued monthly meeting to address any kind of problems or concerns involving the community and police.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, we still meet. We meet in Cornelius at Central, but you know, it's still ongoing. There's no controversies right now, but you know, it's there. And we have, they're not really controversies, but we always have people coming in and complaining to the chiefs directly that they were stopped and they don't know why they were stopped, and they was only because of the, you know, some type of profiling, you know, that was done. And so the chiefs listen and they take note of what, you know, there's is being said, and they go back and look into it. Mm-hmm. So it's a direct connection with the Hispanic community.
Uh-huh. You mentioned that your controversy over the INS agent as being one of the hotter issues. Were you, what did you specifically wind up doing in that context, or how did you specifically feel about it? You must have been getting feedback from both sides, so you must have been kind of in the middle.
And my responsibility was to let the sheriff know what the community felt.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the sheriff felt that you know, it wasn't such a big thing. He couldn't understand why the community was reacting the way it was. But you know, the INS and Hispanics, whether they're here legally or not, whether they're U.S. Latinos or not, has always been adversarial, you know, for some reason. I remember as a kid, every time we used to go into to Mexico, it was always this awful feeling that came over me anyway. I don't know if it was probably more intimidation than anything, but I just felt like, even though I was legally here, that if I said the wrong word, that I was not going to let back in. You know, It was always that feeling, and that's something that especially if you're a legal alien here, where you've got the right to live here, resident, and you're here legally, there's always this cloud hanging over you that at any moment, you know, someone could just, you know, INS could just say, you know, you don't belong here, and you're out of here. Of course, now that really holds true. Specifically, if you're arrested and charged with a felony crime, that's a deportable offense, where before it wasn't. Uh-huh. And so we have people here that are INS holds, waiting to be deported because of the fact that whatever crime they committed is a deportable offense. And so I get people coming in, well, why, you know, he's legally here, why is he being held, and all this. And so I have to, you know, get information and let them know what it is. And until they go to court and have court hearing, and the outcome is whether they're guilty or not. If they're not guilty, then of course they're let go. But if they are, then usually they start deportation procedures, mm-hmm. or proceedings. So yeah. It's really sad, you know, especially when sometimes when they find out that it was a crime that was committed way before this law even took effect, and they're going back that far and bringing it up now.
But the law is retroactive, I take it.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, in some cases when you have bad people, and they're still committing and doing bad things, you know, okay, so, you know, that's the law, that's what it says. But when it's been 10, 15, 20 years since you were in trouble, you know, I don't think that's fair.
Uh-huh, right.
Yeah. It's unfortunate, but...
Does that put you in a real place of conflict to have to sometimes stand behind a law that you think isn't fair?
No, it doesn't put me in conflict. I mean, I sympathize for people going through that because, I've been firsthand. I remember when I was a little kid living in Socorro, Texas. We were already here legally, but my mom once in a while would hire someone to take care of us, like a nanny. And I remember one time specifically that this lady, young Hispanic woman, said, quick, hide, the immigration's here. And sure enough, they knocked on the door. In fact, I remember them coming into the house. I must have been very young, under 3 years old, or I don't remember what it was. And I remember this lady, nanny, picking me up and putting me in a clothes barrel to hide me, thinking probably that I was illegally here. And I remember the INS agent, shining his light on me. They must have known that we were there legally because they didn't take me. They didn't take my sister, but they took the lady.
So maybe she had a problem.
They called my mom, and so they must have known that, and so they took her. So I know how. And ever since then, I've always felt that somebody's going to come and get me.
It made an impression.
Yeah. And so that was always very intimidating to me. Mm-hmm. And even today, I've had occasions to go to INS, to their main offices, and once you go into their building, it's just, you know, it gives you the creeps, kind of, you know, because of the, you know, that, you know, people are there to try to become legalized or to whatever their main purpose in being there, but they always feel very intimidated, you know. They have to, well, almost like, I don't know if you ever had to go into DMV. You know how you feel and how they treat people. The impression is that they treat people really bad. It's really changed since then, the DMV, but that was the same type of environment impression that was left to me. So, you know, I know that they feel intimidated, and I know they feel intimidated when they come here. And so I try to comfort them and have them relax, you know, and try to explain things as best as I can, and offer options for them. You know, we don't give legal advice, obviously, but, you know, I do tell them, you know, this is what's going to happen, this is what's going to go on, so that they know. And at that point, you know, if they need to get a lawyer, I say, you know, it might be wise to get, you know, try to get some legal advice so that you know what your rights are. Mm-hmm. And so within that context, you know, I try to help them as much as I can.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that you sometimes get involved in incidents that maybe community members regard as racial profiling.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that issue?
Sure.
To what extent do you think that is a problem, racial profiling?
I think that I don't see it as much as I used to. Before I started working here, I used to notice it all the time. Particularly when I used to work at Forest Grove at the printing company, I would drive from Hillsboro to Forest Grove every morning. You know, I'd be on my way, go through Cornelius, Forest Grove around 7 a.m. And in one particular period of time, I started noticing that this Forest Grove police officer, every morning when I was going by, because this particular route, Highway 8, going through Cornelius and Forest Grove, there are some nurseries out there past Forest Grove. And so this is the route that, you know, most of those workers would take, most of them, 99% of them being Hispanic. And so, you know, I would be driving, and right at the same time every morning, I'd notice that this particular police officer would have a Hispanic pulled over. And I'm sure it was happening way before I started noticing, but when I started noticing, then I started making notes. Well, at a certain time, because it was really odd. And sure enough, I did that for 2 weeks, and every morning he'd had a Hispanic stopped. And so I said, I got to do something about it. And at that time, of course, I was on the radio. And then also, I was also helping another community member to do driver education classes to help them get their driver's license. And so, and because of that class, they would call me at the radio station and say, you know, we're getting stopped a lot, and this and that, and my family or my husband got stopped, and he wasn't doing anything wrong. And so I started doing, you know, mentioning that on the radio, and started telling people, well, you need to be careful. You need to watch out for this particular police officer. He used to have gray hair, so he used to say, el policía canoso, which is gray-haired one.
Uh-huh.
And so it became a running joke there. So anyway, I started noticing, because I worked in Forest Grove, that this police officer, the same one, would stop someone every morning. Finally, I've had enough. You know, after 2 weeks, I said, well, I'm going to put all my information together. I'm going to go talk to the chief of police. Well, prior to me doing that, I happened to have ran into this police officer in downtown Forest Grove. He was coming out of a restaurant, and I was going in. And I said, can I talk to you for a minute? Do you have a minute? Said, oh, sure. What can I help you with? Very nice. And I said, and I explained to him what, you know, I had been noticing and for how long. Excuse me. And so he got very defensive. And I said, well, you're just wrong. I don't pick on Mexicans and all this and all that. And I said, well, why do you think that, you know, this information that I've gathered gives me that, you know, information or impression that you are targeting Hispanics? You're all wrong, you're all fun. If you try to do anything, you know, you're gonna get yours. He all actually threatened me. And so I said, well, I'm gonna go talk to your chief of police. You can do anything you want, you know. At that point, he had become very rude. And so The next day, you know, I got my information and went in and filed a complaint with the chief of police. And he said, well, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do an IA, internal investigation, and we'll see what comes out. Well, 2 weeks later, the chief sent me a letter, said, well, we conducted our investigation and we find that there's no grounds for any discrimination or that he's targeting Hispanics. And of course, I didn't agree with that, but I said, well, at least I filed my report and it's on record. But 2 weeks later, that police officer was gone.
Huh.
And that problem ended there.
Hmm.
You know, and because of where I, you know, who I am today and the position that I hold in the community, I still get calls. People still come in, even if they live in Beaverton or Tigard or Tualatin, Hillsborough, Foursquare, Cornelius, and they complain to me about those particular agencies. Mm-hmm. And I help them. I write, I tell them, write down exactly what you want me to say, as far as what your version is. And so I usually translate it, and then I go through the proper channels, the complaint or citizen complaint procedures, and I file for them. And so we've been able to reach solutions for them, most of them. A lot of times it's just misunderstandings, cultural misunderstandings, you know. A lot of times they think that, you know, Hispanics give false information by giving other names. And it's not. I tell them, it's not that they're giving you false information. It's just that a lot of times they don't use their full name. The license might say something, but their full name might be different, you know. So it's just a misunderstanding. And so we've been able to bridge the gap in that manner.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's really rewarding when you're able to do that. I deal with many cases of mistaken identity or false ID, that sometimes people use somebody else's ID, and then trying to straighten their records out is really time consuming, and you have to go to court, you have to provide pictures, but I've gone to court with people and told the judge, you know, I've done my investigation and we've determined that this person is not the person that was issued the ticket, and they've cleared their record. And so you get a lot of people like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, that you're able to help and you feel good about it.
Uh-huh. Another problem with respect to the Hispanic community and maybe law enforcement,
mm-hmm.
out here, or maybe I should also describe it as a perceived problem,
mm-hmm.
And I don't hear so much about it anymore, but a few years back there was quite a bit of publicity about gang activity,
uh-huh.
in Hillsborough, and I think it was characterized as Hispanic gangs.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about that situation and how, you know, your own involvement there?
I'm not very involved with it, although I do know that there is gang activity in Hillsborough.
Mm.
I think it's not as bad as it was 2, 3, 4 years ago. I think, you know, during that time, it was really a big problem. And I think maybe it's because people are kind of growing out of it. Those,
mm-hmm.
people that were players at that particular time have grown, and they've realized that, hey, they gotta do, you know, get a, you know, a job and earn a living. But what we do have is a lot of young kids who pretend to be gang members, who pretend to dress the part and do that kind of thing. As I go into high schools and I see kids in there, for the most part, they're decent kids. Even the kids that dress up like gang members, you know, they're just perceived as gang members just because of the way they're dressed. I mean, that's not to downplay the fact that there is gangs. There is. And I'll be one of the first ones to tell you that Hillsborough has a problem.
How does the problem manifest itself?
Well, there's shootings,
mm-hmm.
There's beatings, you know, fights, and the reason that we know about it is because of the fact that, you know, they used to belong, Hillsborough used to belong to our gang unit. They no longer belong, so that's how we were able to get the same information. now, for some reason, they tend to believe that there isn't a big problem of gangs. This is Hillsborough.
Hillsborough Police.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But I know that there is, and I'm not, I'm not the type of person that can walk down, say 10th Street, where a lot of people perceive that's where they hang out, 10th and TV Highway. I'm not the type of person that can easily see that type of activity, only because I know what I'm looking for. I mean, if you were to go out there not being from the area or not being accustomed to being in that area, you might see two Hispanics hanging there and you'll think they're gang members. I might go there and see these two kids and not think that they're gang members. So it's just a perception. But that's what damages the community, is a perception at most times.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. How do you think kids get involved, Hispanic kids get involved in this?
A lot of times,
what are the causes, would you
say? Peer pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the inattention at home.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, nowadays, both parents have to work to be able to provide for the family. And so that leaves kids unattended, not doing anything, nothing to do. Lack of activities, projects, work, after school jobs. I think that all that contributes to the kids falling easy prey to other, gang members. And so, but for the same kid that might be an easy prey for converting them into gang members, you can have a same kid living in the same conditions who will not be intimidated, who will not be recruited, or might be recruited but might not join.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it goes back to family values too.
Mm-hmm.
I've known kids who grew up in East LA who now live here, who always avoided gangs, and they lived right in the middle of the worst kind of environment, and they still didn't join.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he credits it to his upbringing and family values.
Mm-hmm.
So, parent involvement, I think,
is mm-hmm. an important one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think that gang activity here in Hillsborough has created friction between, say, the Anglo community and the Hispanic community? Is that a problem?
No, not in that respect. Okay. I think that there's more friction between the Anglo community and the Hispanic community based on cultural differences and ignorance, I think, a lot of times. Specifically, I think that the impression from the Anglo community of the Hispanics is that they're coming in and taking jobs away.
Okay, so that's a warm, important issue.
Yeah. And which is really not true when you start to think about the jobs that the majority of the jobs that Hispanics have are jobs that nobody else wants,
mm-hmm.
And because of the fact that the employer is not willing to pay what the Anglo wants, and so the Anglo refuses to work for minimum wage, but you have somebody here who's willing to do it, and that's where the controversy is. Why do they come and take those jobs? They make it harder for us, being the Anglo, to negotiate a good, decent living wage.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the worst friction.
Well, maybe just a couple more questions, mm-hmm. and I'll let you go. are there any other issues or specific incidents that you've been involved in you want to recount here that maybe illustrate some aspect of the kinds of problems the Hispanic community faces or the kinds of interaction they have with them?
There's always, in respect to law enforcement, the perception by a good number of police officers, whether they're Washington County, Beaverton, Hillsboro, Forest Grove, Cornelius, is that a good portion of Hispanics or Latinos are driving with no license. I did a study to find out if that was true. And yes, you know, the number of citations that were issued in Washington County was disproportionate to the number of Anglos getting tickets for the same offenses.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I started doing, I started a driver education class where whenever a Hispanic or Latino driver gets stopped and he has no insurance or he has not a driver's license, we refer him to our class. And we've been able to make a big difference. And so the police officers know that if they stop somebody, that they can at least refer them to our classes, maybe waive the citation or issue it, and if with a condition that if they get their license, that you know ticket or citation is going to be dropped.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been able to do a lot of that. The program's been in effect 2 years now, and the first year we had over 300 people go through our program and get their license. Mm-hmm. The second year we had 375 people, and this year we're hoping we're going to top that by 450.
Wow.
We have a class going on here at the sheriff's office, one at Centro Cultural, and on beside the fact that we're helping them to get their driver's license, we also bring in a police officer to talk about community relations. You know, what's your responsibility as a driver? What's my responsibility as law enforcement? So that you guys can talk. You know, we tell people, well, you know, if you get stopped, you know, you have to have this documentation. Also, don't be rude to the officer. Be very cordial so that, you know, and of course we tell the same thing to the officer and say, you know, understand that this is, you know, there might be a language problem. Not that they don't understand you or don't hear you or ignoring you, those kind of issues. And so we try to add some type of cultural diversity so that they understand that, uh-huh. you know, what they're meeting up with. So it's we're trying to bridge the gap. We're also trying to close that gap between the two cultures, and so that there's more cultural understanding of each other, not only of the Hispanics, but of the police or the law enforcement culture,
mm-hmm.
so that they know, well, this is why they stopped you. You know, this is the reasons. And we also tell them, if a police officer stops you for no reason, that's not right. You know, and you need to tell somebody. So, you know, we're educating both cultures at the same time. I mean, I also do police training here as far as, you know, some of the new recruits or some of the new people that are coming on about the Hispanics. And so I tell them, this is, you know, how the name situation is. This is, you know, how things work in the community, so that they're aware. And we have several police officers who are wanting to take Spanish classes because they want to be able to communicate. They want to be able to be understood, you know. So, you know, it's changing for the better, I think. And as you know, some of the newer recent immigrants are probably the ones that are having the most difficulty. But, you know, first generation people, second generation, of course, there's no problems. They know the laws. The kids know the laws too, you know. So it's working. And I think it's for the better of the overall community, the safety of the overall community, I think, especially.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I do remember, though, I still deal with some discrimination issues as far as people who are facing discrimination in housing, and because they come to me and they let me know, well, you know, this is happening and I don't understand why. You know, I don't understand why they want me out, or I don't understand why the neighbor keeps, you know, complaining about me, you know, and so, you know, I deal with those type of issues. Because I remember when we recently arrived here, after we left the labor camp, we rented a house or an apartment in Forest Grove, and I remember being kicked out of the house simply because we were Mexican, you know. And I remember at that time, my sister had befriended someone who was a college professor at Pacific, and that was her only contact. And so she called her friend, and her husband came, and argued for us. You know, so why are you doing this? And says, well, I don't like Mexicans and all this and all that. And so of course, through his help, he was able to. And this was just the property manager, so he was able to contact the owner, let them know what was going on, and the owner came down and found us another place to live and stuff, and fired the other people, you know, the managers. But you know, that was my first experience with discrimination.
And you experienced it here, rather than
And you know, not too long ago, I received an email from old classmates from Artesia, New Mexico, and they said, you know, we're having our 30th year reunion. Are you coming? I said, yeah, and we started talking, and then they asked me, oh, is there any discrimination up there? I said, you know, there's discrimination, sure. I said, and then we started talking about, do you remember being discriminated back in New Mexico in our days? And we don't remember it, but I'm sure it was there. We just never looked for it, you know?
Sure, weren't as aware
of it. Yeah.
I'm also, you mentioned Centro mm-hmm. a little bit earlier in connection with your driver education classes. Mm-hmm. And before we started the tape, you mentioned that you're recently on their board.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect your awareness, at least, of Centro goes back a lot longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just tell me a little bit about your own involvements with Centro, maybe starting from the earliest ones?
Well, I remember when Centro has always been the center of advocacy, I think, for the Hispanic community in Washington County. Whenever there was a controversy, everyone would meet there. I remember back as far as 1972, always going there for help, or for, you know, when we were gathering forces to protest something or other, that was always the meeting place, you know. There's been several different activists that have been involved with that, even some that are still around, but maybe not, they're already retired and things like that. But, you know, I remember vividly several people, Jose Jaime being one of them, Leonel Lucero from Gaston being another. So, you know, it's always been very much a big part of the Hispanic community here. There's nothing that goes on there that just about all the Hispanics don't hear about, you know. So they're very involved with the community. I think more so now, when Sabino came, it's diversified into other type of programs. Before, it was just mostly advocacy type. You know, if you're having a problem with this, come here. We'll show you where to go, what to do. Now it's expanded to not only feeding people and providing a place to gather for work, to involving cultural learning, you know, where they have certain programs, certain events in the community where they want people not only to know what their rights are, but also to keep up their culture, mm-hmm. you know, awareness. So I'm very enthused about being part of it now. Before, I would just go there because there was a meeting, a public meeting, and things like that, you know. I always knew who the director was. I was always involved in that because my association with the radio station, we always, you know, shared information and made public announcements whenever things were happening. So I've been involved in that respect, but not as much as I am now, mm-hmm. you know, which involves the programs and you know, the perception, especially now. Because we want it to be a place where, you know, second, third, fourth generation Latinos can go there to learn, hey, I didn't know that this was a custom, you know, in our culture, or this is a tradition, you know, that we do this at certain times of the year, Christmases or, you know, Palm Sunday or whatever it was, you know. So that's something that's really new. So it's been an experience even for me, because basically I grew up here in the U.S. You know, I grew up here, so I grew up with American traditions. Sometimes you have to step back and say, you know, I want to relearn my culture. You know, it's not just about the language, it's not just about the food, you know, but it's what my grandfathers used to do at certain times of the year culturally, you know.
So Central provides some support
for
that. Okay, well, actually I was going to ask you one follow-up question too, from something we talked about way back in this interview, and that was you said your own band appeared on radio back there, and you were playing or in the early 70s. What was the name of the band?
The first band was called Los Gallitos del Norte, which translated means the little roosters of the north. And then the next one was Virtud Chicana, which was Chicano virtue, stating the fact that it was more of a new age type of thinking. You know, Chicano, the term Chicano, I'm sure you probably heard this, is mostly used nowadays by young students, actively involved in the community. It's more of an educational concept. Whereas back in the 50s, 60s, and not so much the 70s, up to the 60s, it was more of a derogatory term, or it was a term that was used mostly by the what you might consider gangster type mentality, you know, like hoodlums, and if you're familiar with the Zoot Suit riots down in LA back then, that's when those terms started being used. But because of the new generation, they picked up that word. In the 70s, it became popular again with the movement, people fighting for the rights, advocates, you know, and it started becoming really popular. So that's where we were at that time with the band. And so, you know, it was an interesting period, and it was always Spanish music. You know, we never played any English music for some reason. Maybe one or so, but it was something that was really easy. But, you know, in those days, whenever there was a dance, I mean, just about everybody came. It was a family event, you know, so nobody stayed because that was the only entertainment that we had.
Only entertainment specifically from your culture. Okay, well, I want to thank you very much, Lorenzo,
for the interview. Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed it quite a bit myself.
Good.
Happy to meet you, and thank you.
Well, good. Thank you for inviting me.